Thomas B. Taylor, Associate Professor of Church History and Old Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Christian and secular schools. The subject is an emotive one, believe it or not. I don't know what your policies are. I don't know what you think. I don't know what activities your church sponsors. And I've tried to put together a kind of a neutral discussion so that we can look at some of the wider aspects of education, Christian, secular, and whatnot in our culture. It is an emotive subject. And it varies in its application from point to point because there is no emphatic scripture that says what you must do. That's the thing. If there were a battery of scriptures that told us what we needed to do, then we would have a standard and we'd say, that's what we've got to do. I'll look at some scriptures in a bit. But since we have no codified scripture that says, here's what you must do, then we are left into the area of judgment, common sense, practical guidance, and a lot of those other things too. There are some who think scriptures tell you one thing or another. But what they're really thinking is that that's what scripture seems to tell them, and they'd like to apply it to everybody else. And that's true in lots of other areas too. Just take my word for the moment that you can read through the Bible from Genesis to Revelation and hardly find a single word about the kind of school that children go to. You can find a lot about what your responsibility is, but you can hardly find a single word about whether if your son studies Christian, you know, if he studies medicine, whether he has to go to ORU or whether he could go to the University of Rochester or Pennsylvania or someplace like that. We're soon going to have a Christian medical school, you see, and is that what they call it? We're soon going to have it. Well, we're soon going to have something. So there's really hardly any text you can go to that says, here's what has to be done. There may be lots of things we can apply, and there may be a lot of teachings that seem to fit your circumstance better, but that's what makes it emotive. And I've been at church gatherings where people were ready to tear one another's throats out, arguing over, A, what kind of school, and B, where it should be, and a bunch of other things like that. So what we're doing today, taking up some questions and considerations about education as affects our homes, particularly with regard to Christian and secular schools. We're trying to take them up in a non-emotive manner, because if I get mad about my ideas, I won't be able to hear yours. And if I talk about mine very loudly, which you kind of have to do in this room, I won't be able to hear yours either. And yet, in any meeting of the minds, there needs to be an interrelation of the different ideas to help us get our opinions centralized and brought together. And in this particular day and age, that problem is very current with us in the school movement. I'm not really qualified as an expert on schools. I've had 5 children, and 2 of them are still in high school. 3 of them are doing something else. But 2 of them are still in high school, and I've felt that with every child, that my knowledge of what to do for them has diminished considerably. I think I never said much, which helps you not to eat so much crow. But I think that before I was married, I had lots of very good ideas on how you handle children, and wives too, before I was married. Today I look back, hate to watch the Dobson films, to tell you the truth. Today I look back and I see a whole pattern of mistakes. It's a wonder that any of them are normal, if that's what they are. And a couple of them are hardly that. But it's a wonder that any approach it. And after a while, you can simply become unhappy with yourself if you listen to everybody's criticism, everybody's ideas. My children have gone to all sorts of schools. That is not quite right, but they've gone to both public schools and to Christian schools. And we've had experiences pro and con in both organizations. As I will say later, an awful lot depends on the spiritual state of the child. I don't care how old the child is, 4, 5, 6, 24, 25, or 103. An awful lot depends on the spiritual state of the child and on the personality of the child, too. Well, that's all in an introductory sense. Let's stick with these notes, and I'll try. If I try to ramble, I'll try to ramble with them. The question is, how shall our children be educated? It's more of a question now than it was when you were a child, although some of you, that wasn't long ago. When I was a child. Well, say 1900. Say 1900. Let's get it back where it's safe. It's much more of a question now. But I kind of think even when I was a child, it was less of a question. It was assumed that you would go off. I was raised with my grandparents for a few years in Pittsburgh. It was assumed that you'd go off to Public School 6, which was the Schaefer School. Every kid for blocks and blocks just did it. You went there for kindergarten, which was wretched. And if you were lucky, you stayed on for 8 grades. And after 8 grades, you went to Langley High School. And that's all there was to it. And beyond that, it was just assumed that, I think. I'm speaking of the early 30s. I think it was just assumed that everybody kind of followed that same pattern. And my guess is if you went back to 1880 or 1900, unless you were from a Catholic family where they began a parochial school system in Philadelphia about 1850, unless you were from that sort of a background, your whole educational training was assumptive. There was very, very little divergency among schools. And the rank and file of people went to the same schools in the same towns under the same circumstances. So there was really not a great question as to how we educate our young. It was just kind of assumed that that's how it would go. And they would still be reading Dick and Jane 10 years later. I remember when my first child came home from school with his first reader, had the same stories in it that it had when I was in school. Had a new binding on it, and didn't have Tommy Taylor Hates School on this outside cover, but it had essentially the same stories, and that was the assumptive basis. But in the last many years, with a change in public education being very extreme, with a change in morale and influence being very extreme, been a big change, and the question is a big one. The question is, how shall our children be educated? I offer a few notes in historic perspective. The Reformation brought to light the idea that everybody should be able to read and write. Now, maybe the Old Testament hints at that. It may be that the New Testament is not opposed to it. But it was really the great contribution of Martin Luther in the world of education, that if a person could not read and write, he would not be able to study the Bible for himself and know the facts of grace and salvation. So the big watchword in the Reformation was a literate society, so that men and women could study the Scripture for themselves and know the doctrines of grace and salvation. Now, Luther was not able to implement in Germany what we would call a great vast school system. But the ideas were sown by Luther in a very powerful way. And most of the German states in that pre-Bismarckian age, most of the German states had state schools of one sort or another. Many of them were connected with church schools and with church bodies, but they had them. The result was there was a heavy emphasis on basic literacy. And that was true of the post-Reformation schools. It's where you start picking up the three R's, although you have to fudge a little bit on a couple of those. But that's where it was in the post-Reformational school. A great emphasis on basic literacy. The ability to read and write and do simple ciphering and do simple figuring. But the post-Reformational schools were almost always attached in some way to an ecclesiastical body. Even the state schools of Germany and Sweden were actually directed by the churches of those countries. And, of course, even in those countries, universal education wasn't known. It was education of those who were privileged to get there or those who lived close enough to move to it. The idea was that everybody ought to be literate, but you sometimes had to grind your way to get there to make that literacy yours. School systems developed as such in colonial America, and after the coming of the American Constitution, school systems. New England had a school system before the Revolutionary War in which everybody in the local town had to learn to read and write. He had to go to school. They had essentially what we would call an elementary school system. They had a secondary school system, very much like our high school system. That was not required, but the elementary system was required. State of Indiana, Territory of Indiana, had it very early, too. Now, that came, of course, after the Revolution. I merely mentioned that within the colonies and with the early part of the United States came the idea of a school system. And the system would be built around something broader than churches. It would be built around the civilized whole, the population of the state or the territory. Now, to some extent, that was due to the fact that no church could maintain an educational status for the total community in itself. It was easy when there were 50 people in one church. The preacher would teach them all. They'd learn to read and write Latin, Greek, and English, and they'd do it pretty fast, and count and figure and do other things. Connive, too, I suppose. But they'd learn it all pretty fast. But as communities developed larger and you began having urban centers in which there were hundreds of thousands of people, that became an impossibility. And school systems were developed. And in this country, before any place else in the world, there are a lot of things we've done poorly here, and this might be one of them, but it depends on how you view it. But in this country, before any place else in the world, there was a public education system mandated for all, for all. States were supposed to carry it out under the Constitution, but all were supposed to be benefited by public education. It would be a long time till England came to that status, long time till Scotland and various other places. Today, it's quite common throughout the Western world. But it began here out of the colonial movement and the insistence on that sort of thing, an education for all. Well, that education for all could not be maintained by the church bodies. It couldn't be done. If someone wanted to, they could have maintained it for their own. But the scope of it, the breadth of it, the finance of it, was impossible. Here's a fact that a lot of people don't realize. I'm not sure I can say it just right. But if you went back to 1800, in 1800 in this country, only 6% of the total population belong to any churches whatsoever. 6%. Now, that percentage increased a little bit by the time of the Civil War. It was up to about 23%. The books tell us this. I didn't count them. The books tell us this. The religious history of the country and whatnot. Now, there may have been some other things in their favor, but I'm just simply saying that the churches could not maintain the program for all because they were a minority portion of the population. In the last census statistic in this country, 67% of the people in the country belong to some religious organization. And consequently, the religious organization members today are a plurality within a majority within the public image. But back in the colonial period and in the period following that, that situation did not come where we were a majority figure, did not come to be true until after the First World War. And the figure has actually grown since. That doesn't mean there's great spiritual life, because an awful lot of them just belong to something that doesn't have much. But the ideology of belonging was there. So the churches could not do it, and it passed quickly to the state. And as it passed to the state, you have a progressive development of educational systems. You have a progressive development of uniform systems, so that every kid in every school, we ought to drop the word kid and speak with greater dignity in the seminary, every uneducated youth in every school would have the opportunities of learning the same thing at about the same rate. Uniform programs developed, state-led. And they were, for much of our history, built around a core curriculum. The core curriculum means that everybody learns certain things. Everybody learns certain things, learns if everybody is taking spelling, everybody is taking reading, everybody is taking writing. That's a core curriculum. It's the idea that there is a central thrust of the educational process, and everybody is learning that. And in the earlier days of the country, earlier days, I would say, take the period up to 1840, you had a core curriculum with existing values. That's the age of the McGuffey readers. Now, McGuffey was a Presbyterian minister in Ohio who developed a big burden for education and eventually spent much of his life at the University of Virginia teaching English and reading and writing and stuff like that. But see, in the days of McGuffey, in the 1826 period in Ohio, it was very easy to write a primer for the public school for everybody to use, Jew, Gentile, Greek, and everybody else, for everybody to use, but to incorporate in it the existing values of the time, which on the whole were rather moral values. They were still coming over from the Puritan age and from the thrust of the American governmental system. So the core curriculum, say up to about 1840, was largely one of existing values. Everybody studying the same thing, but with the existing values of culture and morality being taught and taught ruggedly. Reading the McGuffey readers is almost like a revival in some ways. And they're still in print, incidentally, and still used in some Christian school groups. But McGuffey essentially was a religious person who moved more and more into education, and quite firm in his belief, incidentally, but also quite committed to the fact of public literacy. Following that age, in the period from about 1840 to 1870, say they're rough dates, you have to believe that, they're rough dates, but that becomes the age of Mann and Greeley, Horace Mann and Greeley. In the age of Mann and Greeley, they will be followed, of course, by Dewey and a couple other fellows. But in the age of Mann, Greeley, and Thaddeus Stevens, and persons of that sort, you have a core curriculum with changing values. These people react against the existing values of the old morality just a little bit and think in terms of changing them into more modern expressions. With all due respect to the memory of Greeley and Mann and Stevens and all these fellows, they were all, quote, good men, quote, and end quote, but not Christians in any sense of the word. And their concept was that education could not be tied to the values of 2,000 years ago. So they all looked for ways to change them in which they would not lose values, but would make them more realistic. Thaddeus Stevens was famous for the expression, fill the schools and empty the jails. He thought that if people were well educated, they wouldn't steal anymore. What he didn't realize was that if you take somebody with criminal tendencies and teach him well, he just becomes a cleverer crook. That's what he and realize, makes a living writing novels about crime and how to commit it. But that was the concept of changing values. The curriculum was still about the same. If you see what American students were studying in 1870 and compare with 1820, there's hardly a difference in it. There's some, but hardly any. But the value system is beginning to change rather drastically. The changes in it were so much that Charles Hodge of Princeton argued for an independent school system for the Presbyterian Church. And for about 30 years, the Presbyterian Church sponsored a parochial-type school system, which they eventually were unable to maintain financially. But at the same time, the Roman Catholic Diocese in Philadelphia, under Bishop Newman, Cardinal Newman, eventually today Saint Newman, or whatever you call it, different Newman. Really, it's Newman. It's really, if you're good at Dutch, or I'm not, see, and so I, but it really isn't Newman, it's Newman. It's a Neumlade Rue or something like that. Bishop Newman, you'll hear them say. But under him, they at the same time launched a system of parochial schools because they felt that, first of all, there was too much Protestantism in the public school system. Secondly, the values were changing from what they wanted them to be. Now, because they had imperatorial powers that Presbyterians didn't have, they could succeed. The bishop could say, every good kid in the parish will go to our schools. But you know, if you tried that in Presbyterianism, half of them would become Baptists the next day just to show you that they wouldn't have to do what you said. And so it was one of those striking sort of things. But the changing values things was noticed by Hodge and noticed by men like Newman and fellows of that similar sort. If you come to about 1880 and move it up to the time of the First World War, maybe slightly beyond that, you'll discover that you still have the core curriculum, but values are now being individualized. The influence of Dewey and Tennant is very pronounced. Absolutes are almost nil. If a thing seems good to you, that's what you want to do. And since that time to the present, we've had less and less of a core curriculum and more of a free curriculum with, quote, end quote, no values being insisted on. Now, there are individual teachers that are quite different, and there are individual schools that are different. There are always exceptions to every principle. You have them, and that sometimes they're the saving factor. But the concept has been one of an increasingly free curriculum. It's by no means totally free. But it's not uncommon to meet somebody in the fifth grade out at Poduncasville who today is studying French. I'm not hostile to that. I'd say the sooner they learn French, the better they'll be able to... The sooner they learn French, the better they'll know it. The sooner they learn it, the better they'll know it. No doubt about that. But it's not uncommon to meet a fellow, he's in the fifth grade studying French. 100 years ago, nobody studied French in the fifth grade. They might be studying altogether Latin or Greek, but nobody studied French. But what I'm saying is not that it's wrong, but he might be studying French in the fifth grade. The fellow who in your house might be studying German in the fifth grade. There might be another one studying Chinese in the fifth grade. And you might look at one of them and say, well, what are you doing in arithmetic? And he might be saying, well, we're not taking that at all this year. Next year we have two classes in arithmetic. And the concept of a free core is developing very, very much. It's by no means total, but the idea of a core is a lost idea in general public education. Generally, that's the case. And the concept of values, absolute values, is really very much diminished. Relative values, always big. That means it's good if you like it, it's bad if you don't. And consequently, we're caught in a situation in which the uniform progress has been against a value system of high morality and thrust. Hope you see what I'm trying to say there. I'm just sketching in historical perspective how we've come to a point where the whole character of education is built around different pivotal points than it was, say, 200 years ago. Now, I think it's much worse, but whether you think it's better or worse doesn't influence it. The fact is that that's how it's come. Now, as these things have come to pass, there have been a number of attempts at individualized instruction to avoid the impasse of that system. Now, one movement has been the parish schools. The parish schools, whether they be of the Presbyterian Church under Hodge or the Catholic Church under Bishop or Cardinal Newman, all of those things, the parish schools. Now, the parish school is the attempt of a local, well, parish, church, local diocese. When you start talking about independent churches, you can no longer use the word parish very much because the term parish suggests not a constituency but a territory. And that's why in Louisiana, the counties are still called parishes, or were the last time I passed by there, although, of course, have religious liberty there, too. But the parish is the idea of a territory, not just your flock. When you start getting independent churches together and Bible churches together, why, you know, you might have 10 people living in my town, but they won't speak to me, and I might have 300 living in yours that won't speak to either of us. It's one of those tricky things in life. But the concept of the parish school was a school that would feed and work for the local church. Along with that came the private schools, most of them of a secular sort, the military academies. When I was a kid, my mother used to get a magazine called The American Magazine. I think it went under with Collier a long time ago, but she got it. And in the back of it were pages on pages of advertising for private schools, military academies at Staunton and at Reading, Pennsylvania, and other places. I used to look at those things and wonder what it'd be like to go to a really good school. A really good school. Of course, they wouldn't have taken me, probably, but I used to wonder what it would be like to go to a really good school. And there would be columns and columns of them there. They were a reaction in favor of individualized instructions. And they'd often say it. They'd often say it, your son will have his own tutor in horseback riding. Something. I didn't need a whole lot of help in that. But maybe if I'd done it right. But they were the private schools. And then with that developed what we call the theme schools. A good example of that is the Montessori system. In almost every community, you'll find a Montessori school. Madame Montessori was a philosophic educational innovator, a philosophical educational innovator. And she concentrated on learning by doing. And so you'll find in almost all the communities around here, if you look hard, a Montessori school in which the child learns with the motions of the body and the hands and various other things following that particular pattern. The last great public advocate of Montessori schools in this country probably was President Truman. He was very big on them and thought that every community ought to have three or four as long as the government didn't have to pay for it. But he was very big on that sort of education. And along with that would come the vocational schools, the economic schools. I don't know when they began. They are very largely a product of this century, but they become a very big thing. And then, of course, the Christian schools, when I say church schools, the word Christian is an ambiguous word. The word church is, too, so we put two ambiguous words together and hope you'll understand what we mean by it. But they become a means of instruction. Now, the only really successful parochial school system outside of the Roman system was the one that the Lutheran church ran for years, and also the Mennonite schools, of which you'll see many aspects in this part of the world, Mennonite and Amish schools, Amish a little further west, but they became a rather dominant form of parochial school system. When you get by those things, what you've done is to look at historical perspective and say, where have we been, where have we come to? And you come to the second thrust I talk about, and that is the educational responsibility spheres. How much of my child's education am I responsible for? It can't be for everything, because he's an individual. And just like in the book of Ezekiel, he can't look up to God and say, well, it's my father's fault, I'm a sinner. He ate a sour grape and my teeth are on edge. I can't be expected to teach him everything either. What are the educational responsibility spheres? Well, in terms of biblical perspective, I note generally three basic passages. I'll not look at them in detail, but I'll note them. The famous one is Proverbs 22:6. Which requires a lot of study in the Hebrew for a fuller meaning, Proverbs 22:6, and training up a child in the way he should go. It suggests that each child ought to be developed in the way that his abilities lie. That's really what the Hebrew suggests. It doesn't suggest that there's one way and you kick everybody and they fall into it. It suggests that each child as an individual should be instructed and guided in the line of his capabilities and his thrust, in the way that he as a child is best able to walk. That certainly is part of the responsibility spheres in biblical perspective, to see that each child is developed along the line that is, quote, suitable for him. Sometimes that's hard to know. I'll just stop and ramble for half a minute and tell you that I always loved school after I got out of kindergarten. I hated kindergarten with a passion. They made me go 2 years. They said I wasn't socially adjusted at the end of 1 year and I had to go back. I hated it with a passion. I got a licking every day. I got one when I left home, and I got most often got one when I came in at night, and got a couple during the day, too. I had a terrible 2 years in the Schaefer School in Pittsburgh in kindergarten. And the lady that had me retired when I left, I think, took an early retirement. But after I got out of kindergarten and got into first grade, things went better, and I have loved school. I have really enjoyed it. I had the misfortune of going to a rural school district, which in my day only met 7 months of the year. Oh, I hated that. My cousins in the city got to go for 10 months. I used to think how good it would be to live in the city and go to school for 10 months. Of course, it was a lot easier than farming, I guess. That might have been part of it. I don't know. But I loved it so. Suddenly, I'm a father. Suddenly, I have children. My wife was always a scholar, always on the honor list somewhere. Of course, neither one of us were at the top, but she was always on it somewhere, and I bobbed between it and restriction depending on how much I wanted privileges that month. But she was always up high. She was always a very good student, and I certainly had reasonably good grades, but we both loved school, loved to read, loved to study. Suddenly we're parents. Suddenly we've got children. Big news, none of them like school. You talk about a blow. You thought, boy, I mean, we're positive. We talked up school, go to school, have good times, had fun and games with their books. And suddenly you've got five children. I think maybe the youngest one likes school a little bit, but hates to admit it. But suddenly you've got five children, none of whom like school. They see it as a necessary evil that they can't get out of. But when they're done, they're done. I worried about having money to send them to college. I might as well save that worry. You see, I might as well save that worry completely. And I said to my son as he was graduating from high school, I said to him, I'd like him to go to Bible school or go to college. He's 18, of course. I tried to influence him as much, but there's a point where you can no longer command and say, thus thou shalt do. I kind of want him to go to college or Bible school. I can still see the look in his eyes. He's a comfortable, pleasant fella. He looked at me and he said, Dad, he said, I've studied enough. Swallowed hard. Joined the Navy. That's where he is today. Dad, he said, I've swallowed hard. Studied enough. For a father who never studied enough and always wanted to study more, that was tough to take. But I had to see that my way was not his way in terms of life. And to train him up in the way that he should go was not to try to make him me all over again. When I was a kid, I bitterly resented my father doing that to me. And I suddenly discovered I was trying to do it to my own kids. It was a tough blow. But it saved me a lot of money. Train them up in the way they ought to go. The second passage is Deuteronomy 6, where it's emphatically stated that we're responsible to teach them the law of God, to teach them the truths of God's word. That's a home function in Deuteronomy 6. It's interesting to take the whole book of Proverbs, incidentally, and go through and see what father and mother are supposed to give to their children. It's the word of instruction over and over again. But Deuteronomy 6, a home function to teach them the word, the law of God, and to be prominent enough in it that they hear it and learn it from their earliest years. And then taking the passage in Titus 2, it goes a little beyond parents, but I make an application out of it. Taking the passage in Titus 2, we are responsible to teach those who are following us by a generation the necessary truths of life and relationship one with another, and the necessary values of honesty and integrity. Titus 2. Aged women teaching younger women, aged men teaching younger men, but teaching them the value systems of the Word of God and the principles of integrity. And those are things that we are to teach our own in biblical perspective, no matter who you are or what your own are. But they are things that I am to teach, or at least to attempt to teach. Now, some characters won't learn, but I'm to attempt to teach them. And if I look at any type of education as a means of avoiding those primary things, then I've got things in the wrong order. Some people look at the school system as a means to make up what they can't do. Well, as I'll mention in a moment, there's an area where that's true. But in the primary areas where God has given me responsibility, I cannot reasonably expect anybody else to undertake that for me. By the grace of God, it might happen. Fortunately, my own children have occasionally come across somebody who would help them in areas that I should have helped them, but wasn't able to or didn't try. And so by the grace of God, it might happen, but I can hardly demand it. That's what we call the biblical perspective, basic things we're expected to teach our own. Now, when you come to a practical analysis on that, you'll see that for advanced matters, you need other teachers. There are some here in the school who are enormously competent in mathematics. They can teach their children all the mathematics. There are others that are enormously competent in English. They could work on that. But sooner or later, you come to a point that's beyond your expertise. A lot of my students could not teach anybody a thing about handwriting, I'd like to tell you, except how not to do it. So when you get to advanced matters, you come into an area where teachers are needed. And for the remotely advanced areas, the more advanced, you need specialists. I'm going to teach my son surgery? No. I hate the sight of blood. Well, not really. I'm not much bothered by it. I'm a great blood bank type. I should have brought my gallon pins to prove it, you know. But things you boast about on earth, I think you, well, never mind. But I could never be a surgeon. They don't call me Shaky Taylor for nothing. You can say, we told you you got the appendix. What are you doing with his stomach? Well, slipped. Just that kind of thing. Well, you need advanced teachers. You need specialists. And for those things that we do poorly, we often need remedialists. That's where the Bible counselors come in. The Bible counselors. We often need remedialists for the things we do poorly. The whole concept of sex education is a big one today. My father's advice on sex education was simple. My father said, you'll find out. That was the whole scope of it. I didn't sit around with a notebook asking him questions either. But my father said, you'll find out. Lived on a farm. Hate to tell you the kind of things you find out on the farm. But anyhow, that was his whole concept of it. Consequently, if I had had to depend on learning from that sort of thing, I don't know what I might have found out. So you read somebody's book, you hear somebody's lecture, you receive somebody's help. There are areas in which, and there are areas that come kind of naturally in the course of life too, along many different areas. But remedialists are needed for the things we do ineptly. Now the guidelines in finding the right kind of teachers, you have your biblical perspective on what we're to do, and beyond what we're to do, we need teachers and specialists and remedialists. The guidelines for finding them, of course, are first of all to make sure you select those persons whose values are worthy of following and who can give the sort of guidance that will build into more concrete, structured thinking patterns. And the big guideline of prayer is not to be diminished for a moment. We pray about them. And the fourth one of my guidelines is kind of a humorous one. When you realize you've made a mistake, you need somebody to console you. I saw a fellow playing the piano one day. Now, I'm not a musician, and Mr. Nair is not here, and you may all be music majors, but he sat playing the piano with his elbows out like this and his fingers up like that. I'd watched my wife give hundreds of piano lessons and agonized through listening to a couple thousand. So when I saw a fellow sitting like that, I thought maybe he had muscle trouble. But I said to him, I don't know what I said, but I discovered he'd gone to a particular piano school where they taught him to play like that. He had a teacher that taught him like that. She liked the elbows extended so the fingers could come straight down. She liked the jab method. She didn't like this flop them up and down. She liked the bounce and pounce method. Maybe that's the big thing today. I don't know. And I said, well, why in the world did they send you to a school like that? He said to me, who knows? Who knows, he said. Who knows? He said, I've asked him that many times myself. My father always says, well, it's too late to do anything about it now. He said, I don't know what they could have sent him to another school, too. He's one of those fellows who bought an organ kit and built a Heath organ in his room. Far too big to get out of the room. Far too big. I remember looking at it saying, maybe no music school would have been good for him. I don't really know. But I can still see him playing. That's a slight exaggeration, but it's not much. I have to get him up high for the desk so you can see him. It's not much. It's a slight one. It's not much. So in a situation like that, you need somebody, not to condemn you, but somebody to say, well, you made a bad choice. Doesn't do you any good to kick yourself for 50 years. It's like sending your son off in the case of... how many have ever seen Gilbert and Sullivan, the Pirates of Penzance? Pirates of Penzance. Yeah, you remember that they want the boy. What they want him to be? They want him to be, anybody remember? A pilot. A pilot, is that right? A ship's pilot? They want him to be a ship's pilot, but the maid who hears it thinks they said pirate, and she takes him and gives him to the Pirates of Penzance to teach him how to be a pirate. And she said, well, I thought they said pirate. Ah, it's too late to do anything about it. He came out all right in the end, too. Too late to do anything about it in time to come. And so you need somebody just to kind of console you. And that's not the minimal thing in this area. It doesn't do any good, as I'll say later, to recriminate with yourself all your lifetime and blame yourself for everybody's failures. You have to go ahead and live positively. When we actually come down to the concept of the schools and the problems, we discover that there are some choices available in the educational quest. In a community like we live and where you may live too, the choices center largely around three areas of schools. They center around the Christian school, which is broadly defined. Christian school is broadly defined as an, don't write this down, it's broadly defined as an academic institution which professes loyalty to Christ and the Scriptures. It professes it. Whether it lives it or not, it professes it. It's an academic institution that professes loyalty to Christ and the Scriptures. That's what a Christian school is by definition. And then there's the secular academy, which in essence is a private school, committed along certain lines or along certain principles, depending what it may be. It may be a school that specializes in something like some of the military schools. But the private academy, the reading schools and that, the private academy, and then there is the public school. I mentioned in a parenthesis the private home. I should have made a four out of that, but I didn't think about it. I had the whole page typed, and I was too lazy to do it over. So I just lumped it there. Now, that's an extremely, sometimes it works well, but it's a... You better think twice before you undertake it. It is legal in Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, if you want to teach your children strictly at home and have an accepted core curriculum structured thing, you may do it. You may have to get a court officer to help you convince the school district, but you may do it. But I'd say think twice before you do anything like that. Get ready for a lot of grief, aggravation, and wondering what to do when the assignments aren't done on time. But those are the three options that are most prominent for us, the choices. When you talk about the factors that influence you towards one or the other, I mentioned two or three factors regarding Christian schools that are important. The first one is, there are several varieties. Boy, is there a wide difference in Christian schools. There are several varieties. There are the Christian schools which are controlled by an individual church. They are parochial in the purest sense of the word. Then there are the Christian schools which are controlled by parents, the parent-controlled Christian school. There are some varieties of that in which parents of different churches kind of combine the two and have a school that's responsible to, say, five churches with parents from all five making up their board. And then, of course, there are the Christian schools like the ACE school program and the Baker school and the Alpha and Omega, several varieties of schools that often are parochial but are not conventional in their movement towards what's being done. So the mere word Christian school only identifies an academic community that professes to be loyal to Christ and the Scriptures. There are wide varieties in them, and they all have to be considered in the light of your children and what your children can work at very well. We spend some time studying those things in Christian ed in the seminary, and I've often noted that a self-motivated child with a half-decent personality does beautifully under the ACE and the Alpha and Omega system, does beautifully. But a non-self-motivating child, in spite of all claims to the contrary, a non-self-motivating child just slugs it out, brother, and has a tough time and winds up having to make a lot of adjustments in his educational process. Now, I wouldn't say he's a failure because that goes beyond the school system. That's within you. But there are all sorts of varieties in a Christian school, and you have to bear that in mind when you're thinking of one. And then I mentioned, too, with quotes on Christian, being Christian is not enough. Professing to be loyal to Christ and the Scriptures is not the ultimate definition. It's not enough in itself. Now, the word Christian is widely used today, and we're finding liberalism in grade schools and high schools, just as we find it in seminaries and colleges. The use of the word Christian is not enough. Sometimes you actually get into a circumstance where the school that's called Christian, if it is not totally that, is a bigger pain in the neck than the agnostic institution down the street. Because when my son comes home from agnostic U, I look at him and say, they're not believers, what do they know? I'm just making this up. But when he comes home from where he studied with someone who professes to be a believer and whom you've got to respect, but who's got a lot of crackpot ideas, it's another. As my daughter would say, that's another can of worms, she would say. But that's another proposition to be thought about. But you have to, those are just simply factors. And likewise, the factor regarding the Christian school on the integration of community and church. I'm not using integration in the social sense, but in the weaving together of community, church, and home in that particular thrust. All of those things have to be borne as factors regarding the Christian school and thought through when you think of it. Regarding the other two choices, the secular and the public academy, the factors you have to be mentioned is, now, first of all, that humanistic values generally predominate. That's almost totally true today. Schaeffer's article on secular humanism recently and others take it up fairly well. Humanistic values almost totally predominate, not with individual teachers, but with the systems, they generally predominate. You'll have individual teachers who, you'll actually have godly people. You'll have them run the gamut from Marxists to patriots, from godly to ungodly. Individuals will have very high standards. But humanistic standards in which man is the chief end of everything, they generally predominate. That's a factor to be borne in mind. You'll discover that the value standards are very high in fluctuation. Very high in fluctuation. I visited a school once with the parents. Went to see a child in the play. And the parents said to me, they said, what we're proud of in this school, this was a secular school, they said, is that the administration is absolutely and totally opposed to smoking. For everybody but themselves. Here's the administrative officer who forbids any smoking on the ground, strolling through the hall, dragging on a fag. Well, believe it or not, that's a fluctuation. If he wanted to go home and sit in his, But within the framework of the building, to say there will be no smoking here except mine is a value standard that's in fluctuation. And, of course, what it always results in is a lot of washroom smoking, lounge smoking, typewriter room smoking, and a lot of heating up the atmosphere otherwhere. And you face that tremendously. Value standards are high in fluctuation. When I was in Hatboro, Horsham, my children went to the Pennypack Elementary School, which was a very good school, and we enjoyed it. We had a principal there named Corso. He has since died, but he was a very fine man, a man committed to high standards. At that time, they were having arguments in West Virginia over immoral literature in the school systems. That was about 15 years ago. And there was a big court trial going on over it. Went to a parent-teachers thing one night, and Dr. Corso read from the newspaper about that, and he looked at us and he said, "I want you parents to know that this will never be a problem in Pennypack School while I am here," he said. "I believe in morality and in decency," and he said, "we will not tolerate these vulgar things in our curriculum at this school." He said, "there are plenty of things at any school." He was very emphatic on it. And as far as I know, Pennypack is still a very good grade school. I just haven't lived there for years. But he was very emphatic on it. But the key words were, "as long as I am here." That's the key words. Now, I know anything can change. But a system in which the value standards fluctuate quickly from administrator to administrator is much more subject to change. As far as I know, it's still a very good school. The person who followed him was likewise a lady of very high standards. So as far as I know, it still is that. But I'm just saying that the value standards fluctuate wildly. They fluctuate wildly. When I was in high school, enough stories. The community church, the value standards are high and the parental input is minimal. Parental input is minimal. I do think that more believers ought to be involved in things like school boards and whatnot, but you'll discover that the parental input is minimal. You'll find people who listen. I don't believe in being nasty about those things, like threatening to bomb the place, but you'll find people who listen, but you'll find parental input is minimal into either the academies or the secular system. I mentioned a couple of factors on the bottom of page 2 that for all schools, Christian and secular, have to be borne in mind. First of all, the school influence is greatly overrated in the lives of students. I'm just saying that dogmatically. It is greatly, I'll argue about it later, it's greatly overrated. The educators have made the picture to make themselves look important. Greatly overrated. And people say, "well, we have your children so many hours a day." Yes, that's right. But they don't have them at the most critical hours of the day, unless you send them to a boarding school. The most critical hours of the day are the formative hours of early morning and the hours that are spent in the evening before retiring. They are the formative hours of the day. And people of any persuasion, given those hours, can offset almost anything else that goes on in the framework of life and activity. Some of us don't try. We kind of ignore the family at night. I no longer tell them to stay out of my hair. There's not enough of it. But I'm not saying the school doesn't have a big influence. I'm saying that it's vastly overrated. Vastly overrated. But peer pressure, that's of enormous consequence. Peer pressure is of enormous consequence. And that is the real killer. That is one of the great advantages for children and adults, too, to have peers that are compatible to their own ideologies. Peer pressure is vastly underrated in terms of things. In a summary note, I mentioned that for all schools, Christian, secular, and everything else, adequate teachers and integrated programs are of prime importance. Integrated, again, I mean that math is taught so that the math teacher is not fighting with the history teacher. The program works together for one whole thing. Those things are very important. Now, when we start to balance the concepts for the different districts, I offer plus and minus factors in all of these things. I'll mention them quickly here. I offer plus and minus factors. I don't offer them all. I just mention a few. The plus factors for the Christian school, I mention 4. You could probably double that, but I mention 4. One is the fellowship of other Christians. The fellowship of Christian children, the fellowship of Christian teachers, even the fellowship of the Christian janitor. In some schools, the janitor is one of the most important of all people. He's the buddy of lots of guys who don't have anybody else to buddy with. I remember the janitor where I went to grade school. It was a place called Dorseyville. His name was Mr. Orr. You know, he was retired from something or other. He sat in the furnace room. And all the disgruntled boys in the school would come to the furnace room to see Mr. Orr. I don't remember that he had any spiritual values to impart. I don't remember. He might have, I don't remember. But I remember that he was always sitting there, and you could come in the furnace room and tell him what was on your mind, and he'd say, "well, let's look at it this way, Tom," he would say. And my impression is that over 20 years in the Dorseyville school, he probably had as great an impact as any three teachers put together. That's my impression. Among the fellows. I don't know who the girls go to. They weren't allowed in the furnace room. Talk about prejudice. No girls were allowed in the furnace room. But that's one great advantage, fellowship. The second great advantage is an assumptive one, understanding. That is that people, not everybody who goes to a Christian school is a Christian, but the rank and file, see, reach out to meet that community need. And the concept is an assumptive one of understanding, that there will be an emotive heart that reaches out to the pupil. You'll find that with individual teachers in public school systems. You'll rarely find it with the rank and file of the district. Individuals, yes. The rank and file, rare. There's also the concept of value standards which are pinned to the Word of God, or should be. Value standards that are pinned to the Word of God, or should be. The student is instructed not to lose his temper, hopefully by a teacher who doesn't lose his or her temper, because the control of your tongue and life is a way in which you show the reality of God's control of your being. Now, none of us are perfected in the flesh, so don't do anything to make me lose my temper. But theoretically, that's how it should be. And then, of course, there's the theistic-centered worldview, awfully important. The student is taught to see his duties and obligations in the light of God rather than the light of man. Those are four giant plus factors. The minus factors are sometimes in facility. Facility isn't everything, but it is something. That's not always. It's sometimes in facility. Sometimes in facility. The students who are studying astronomy back in high school where I went years ago, today it's got the same name, went to Mars High in western Pennsylvania. It's still Mars High School, but the students who study astronomy in Mars High School now get their lessons in a planetarium, Dr. Newman. Is that what you call it? They sit back in chairs that swivel back while arrows appear as if by magic on the dome above them, and they see that this is what it is and that's what it is and something else is what it is. And they sit and gaze. They know which end of a telescope to look through or which part of it to look in and all that sort of thing. Oh, that's a giant facility. Don't say, does it make them better students or not? But if they wanted to study, it would. If they wanted to study, it would. Giant facility. Whereas sometimes in our Christian school, we struggle to get one good overhead projector. Sometimes. See, we just like them to see one good overhead projector. Although I must say that where my children are currently in school, the Lord has blessed us with really good facilities, I think. Improving facilities, too, but that happens to be sometimes a minus factor. The minus factor that occurs with some is also a matter of group equation and legalism. And what I mean by that is that you get the idea that we're the only people going to heaven and the only people doing God's will right here in the school. So next week you're going to play basketball against another Christian school, and your chant is, we'll smash them, those compromisers, those Arminians, we'll smash them. Those anti-tribulationists, we'll smash them. We'll really... Happens kind of easy. I'm not saying that's a permanent thing, but that is a minus factor. It is sometimes hard for anybody living in a niche where he is not exposed to a rye to believe that there are other equally valuable people in the world. It's a minus factor. I'm not saying it can't be overcome. It's a minus factor. And the third one, of course, is the oversimplification of issues. Oh, that's a big one. If your children went to Christian school, they wouldn't be having this dope problem. If they went to Christian school, they wouldn't, you know, they'd know how to read and write. Well, maybe so. Oversimplification is one of the big things. And that's very much where preachers are guilty, especially preachers that are trying to develop a Christian school. All of you in the room today who are preachers are exempted. But that's very much where a lot of them are guilty. They're trying to develop a Christian school, and they look out and say, if we had a Christian school, your children wouldn't be subjected to violence. Violence is in the heart of people. It's not in the building. Not in the building. I've always yes, enough stories. I mentioned three qualifying notes looking at the Christian school, that you have to be aware of the potential of societal polarization. That is an us and them mentality. There's us Christians, we're the good guys, and there's all the rest of them who hell should open today. See, every problem can be dealt with if you know what it is. But the societal polarization is a very big thing. And it's one of the things that bothers me in America. There seems to be an increase of it right now. But that's one of the factors. And then, of course, the inevitable, that word doesn't tell you very much, but inevitably, see, everybody has to face the world as it really is. And if one thinks that the Christian school prevents one from facing the world as it really is, that's the wrong reason for using it, in my judgment. Because inevitably, you have to face the world as it is, and you need to learn to do it right where you are. And there's plenty of it in the Christian schools. You can face the world there realistically. But if it's thought to be a monastic cop-out to avoid certain problems in life, then that's a bad use of the ideal. And the third qualifying factor is the danger of proxy living, the danger of somebody else doing your living for you. And that's where Christian teachers and fellows like myself are sometimes, you know, the student says, well, can I eat green peppers on my omelet? That's an absurd illustration. That's the kind that are safe. The student says, can I use green peppers on my omelet? And you say, green peppers often cause me to belch. So I never use them on my omelet. And the next thing you know, actually, I love green peppers no matter what they do. But the next thing you know, you've established a proxy living technique. And student X is always being told what you do as if it were what the Bible said you should do. That's one of the dangers. That's one of the factors to be thought about, qualifying areas. Now, when we come down to the secular establishments, I'm somewhat prejudiced in these areas, but when we come down to the secular establishments, the plus factors, I mentioned three. The first one is facility. They often have remarkable facilities. Oh, we paid for it. They ought to have good ones. But they often have remarkable facilities. They often have good things. And I don't begrudge that. Their wood shop in the school, when my children went to Penn Ridge, the wood shop in the school, that's what you'd want for a wood shop. It was not one bandsaw, a lathe that worked only part of the time, and a hammer with a crooked handle behind a door that said, wood shop. See, it was a wood shop where any cabinet maker could have gone and worked with expertise. And the same thing was true of some other areas too. The facility. Sometimes the facilities are not well used, but they often have that as a plus factor. They also have as a plus factor, very often, the factor of societal development in that the individual student learns to live in and with a wide range of people which is more truly representative of his or her total society. They learn that if there's some kid that always wants to bust them on the head, they've got to figure out a way to deal with that other than saying, I'm going to report you at chapel tomorrow. They've got to learn to do that. I was often in fights when I was a boy because I was a skinny, emaciated boy who through much of my school days rode, at one time 13 miles and much of the time 7 or 8 miles by bus to school. But for a number of years, I rode 13 miles. I was a skinny, emaciated youth. I attained my adult height by the time I was 13. But I weighed, when I finished high school, only weighed 93 pounds. You can see I was no Charles Atlas at any stage of the development. I was a skinny, emaciated youth whose Adam's apple stood out about 4 inches. Today, my continuous neck hides it completely, but stood out about 4 inches. Had one of the super cases of acne of all time. You could hardly tell where the pimples left off and the skin began. And I was a prime specimen for abuse on the school bus. There were always a few. I was a prime specimen. We sat on long benches facing each other, not in individual chairs. I always wore a hat and I always wore a necktie, which were dumb things to do. And my shoes always smelled like the barn, which was likewise stupid. But anyhow, that's how it was. And so pulling my necktie and taking my hat, they were the big things to do. And I many times, many and many a day, I was a mile from the bus stop to our house. And many a time I walked that mile with big tears in my eyes. I loved school, but I hated it. What's wrong? My grandfather said something to me that if I said in the context of my Christian school, would probably get my children expelled. Well, maybe not. There are other things that they've put up with them, so maybe not. But my grandfather said to me, he said, the first time you hit one of those bullies, he said, I will give you $5. Boy, you're going back to where $5 was a lot of money. And one day I sat in a school bus. Sometimes you weren't tormented, but one day I sat in a school bus, and a particularly vicious tormentor looked me up to sit apart from me. He hadn't sat down 1 minute till he was pulling my necktie and making wise comments. And I tell you, the frustration wells up in you in a way you'd hardly believe. I was plenty wiry, because to work on the farm, you got to be wiry, but I was not big, tall and thin, but I was plenty wiry. And suddenly, all of the emotion of that frustration came up in me, and I remembered what my father had said once. My father was full of good sayings. My father said, well, when somebody's pulling your necktie, that means he's not able to defend himself. Boy, this kid had my necktie pulling it like this. So he's pulling it like this. And all that frustration welled up in me, and I hit him in the mouth. I knocked out 3 teeth from the upper jaw. I hit him in the mouth as hard as I could hit him, and followed it up with a chop to the side of the face. I hit him with both hands as hard as I could. I'm not joking. I knocked 3 teeth out of the upper jaw. And, of course, the whole bus was suddenly terribly silent. I sat there glaring at him. I kind of hoped he'd make, but he just grabbed his mouth and began to cry. Well, it worked out in time. They put 2 of the teeth back in and stuck another one in his place, and I'm not terribly proud of it today, but I learned to deal with a problem. And you know, it was the last time I was troubled by him, and it was almost the last time I was troubled on the bus. I got a great help a month later when a punier kid than I was from Pittsburgh moved out. But that's societal development. That's societal development. There was no con. Maybe it would have been better if we'd have prayed about it. But that's learning to live in a society where there are a lot of different brackets. Not every boy could do that. It took me 2 or 3 years to get the courage. My granddad gave me the $5. Then he said to me, he said, remember, it's just $5 for the first one, he said. And then, of course, there's the curriculum breadth. There's the curriculum breadth. The breadth of courses that are open, that is a plus factor. But there are lots of minus factors. The minus factors are huge. The humanistic philosophy, that's a minus factor. I hate to say it, see, there are individuals that it's different. But the philosophy of all accounts is you getting ahead. That's a big factor. And that's a minus one. That the world is built around you, and as long as you're doing what you want and pleases you and doesn't hurt anybody else, go ahead and do it. That's a crazy philosophy, but that's very big in the public school medium. And then the whole attitude of who cares about eternal things or values or God, as long as we progress. Attitudes of corruption. I was working for a contest when I was in school. And you'd think when I was there, they were all honest. I was working for a contest. And my faculty advisor, suggested to me a way that I could cheat cleverly and win and never be caught. My faculty advisor. No, I certainly didn't cheat. I'm the kind that gets caught when they cheat. But I remember being appalled at that. And when I spoke kind of reproachfully, I said, well, I don't really think that's what you ought to do. Something like, you know, I spoke rather timidly but reproachfully. The faculty advisor said, well, do you want to get ahead or do you not? Yeah, that was the big thrust. And then the matter of ideals. Ideals. What's set before us, child, as the good goal of life? I think we have to be careful about that in Christian schools, too. But at least there we have the Bible, and we have the fellowship of other believers. But what's set before the child is the ideal in life, which in so much of the secular world is simply a whole bunch of materialism. The ideals are invariably materialistic. And those are factors to be borne in mind. I mentioned a couple qualifying notes on that, too. I mentioned a qualifying note that in the secular establishment, there's a tendency to level ideals, to make everybody's idea and ideal as important or as good as anybody else's, and to bring with that a relativism that, bound with an undisciplined structure, makes erratic behavior in later life. The loss of discipline in the secular establishments has been, in my mind, the biggest single loss other than any availability of scripture truth in itself. The loss of discipline. In my earlier days, I went to this school in Dorseyville when it was little, and there were 4 classes in, well, I can't remember exactly, but quite a number of classes in one room. One woman taught them all, and she taught them everything. And I'm sure that there were a few people who were disorderly. But there were not many, and they were not disorderly law. I'm guessing there were 35 or 40 people, and I'm guessing, but it was a pretty full room. There was more than one grade. She walked around with an eye that could freeze you on your chair. And if you were writing notes, and she probably didn't know what karate was, but if you were writing notes, she could leave your wrist limp for about 5, you know, notes to a friend. She could leave your I used to slump down in my chair. I'd slump down till my head was on the back of the desk in front of me, like that, and I'd hold the book. She would walk behind me. She would walk and grab me by the hair in the back of my head and pull me to an upright position and about 2 inches higher than that. And while everybody in the room, see, they didn't realize they weren't supposed to embarrass you. While everybody in the room laughed, she'd say, "Are you going to sit up, Tommy Taylor?" I'd say, "Yes." Miss Borland was her name. I'd say, "Yes." I'm not saying if that's good or bad or not, but the complete loss of discipline is one of the very marked things. Now, in some schools it's different, but in many it's very pronounced. Many it's very pronounced. Well, let me mention a couple other things. See, we offer no resolutions. We talk about the matters, but I'll offer a couple notes in a minute. For both schools, whether they be Christian or secular, there are considerations that have to be made. One of those is the fact of how that particular school ties into the community and how the community influences it. There are some communities where the local school has higher ideals than almost any Christian school I've ever known. They are few and far between, but they do exist. And there will be sometimes a circumstance in which the school that you prefer is in a community 40 miles away. And you wonder about the development of life if you're detached. I've long discovered if you live 10 or 15 miles from a church, it's hard to really be part of its total program. Not impossible, but it's tough. You've got to work at it with great dedication. So the way in which the school fits into the community and the way in which it is helped by the community, a very big factor for all schools. And then the acceptance factor as to whether or not its work is viewed as satisfactory work. Again, whether it's Christian or secular, it doesn't make any difference. There are some secular schools in some of the larger cities where I've lived that when you send a transcript to college, the registrars chuckled. They could hardly turn you down, but they just instinctively knew that if you went to a particular school, secular or Christian, you didn't get much of an education. Their policy was turn them out as fast as you can. And so the acceptance factor of the school is a very big thing. And likewise, the standards that are emphasized in the given locale. Does the particular school that you're thinking of, does it find itself in agreement with the standards that you want? Or the standards that the locale calls for. I had a rather unfortunate experience in that with one of my children. You don't mind. Yeah, it's too late to mind. But one of my children learned all of the rationale for Christian smoking in a Christian school. She learned all the rationale that there were great theologians that smoked and did various other things. Well, I the Christian school is not a reform school, but but I didn't expect that child to gain an apologetic. Her father says we don't smoke in this house. I didn't expect that child to get an apologetic that would say, "Well, listen, do you know that the theologian so-and-so smokes a cigar and he's a godly man? And do you know that nowhere in the Bible does it say thou shalt not smoke?" I didn't expect that. I mean, I those things are right, incidentally. I don't deny those things. But I didn't expect a curriculum to produce within. Now, again, it's not all. I'm not blaming this. I'm just telling you what happened. I didn't expect that particular kind of reaction. I'm not sure what I did expect. I was kind of stunned when I got over it. But that's how life goes. And then, of course, the potential input or control with the school. How much input can you have with it? Will they listen to you if you have a problem? Control is maybe a bad word. But how much input can you have? How much influence can you exercise? And that's a very big thing, the total amount, a very big thing. Well, the critical questions are these four. What will best supplement the home? I think the way the culture stands today, that almost any Christian school is a better supplement to the home. But they all have to be studied with care. But note, a supplement for the home, not a substitution for the home. I remember coming home from school. I was not a Christian until I was 18. But I remember coming home from school, my mind was full of stuff. Stuff I wanted to tell my mother. Or anybody. We lived rurally, my mother was always there. And my mother always listened. I don't know how she put up with the drivel. But she always listened. I was the oldest of six children. And I would storm in the door, of course we would soon, I'd storm in the door and I'd say, "Mom, you know what Ed Mitchell did today? Ed Mitchell did the funniest things. And in the next hour or so, around the house and in our little barn and whatnot, I would recite to my mother all of the drivel of a day's activity. I don't know how she stood it. A couple years later, my brother was doing the same thing, and my sister was doing the same thing. Now, that's one of the things I remember well. My mother did lots of things well, but I remember that well. She was there to listen to me when I wanted to talk. I hate to tell you how I feel for the child who comes home from school to an empty house. I just hate to tell you how it's a formative time. Sometimes it can't be helped. Sometimes it can't be helped. We have to understand that there are circumstances in life beyond our control, and sometimes it can't be helped. But I feel for that. Maybe not one day, but day after day after day after day. Come home and get your snack and do your homework. I'll see you at dinner. I feel for that child. In that situation, I feel that the parent is letting the school substitute for the home. Sometimes it can't be helped. Did I say that a minute ago? But a lot of times it could be helped with thoughtfulness. My own children are a little like I was in some ways. They come home babbling, relating about the notes that were written, the things they babble about. You think they should have had their hands slapped for sometime. But they came home babbling. My wife or I, one of us, tries to be home when they come home. Once in a while, you can't do it. Once in a while, things happen. We try to be there, and when I'm home and they come storming in the house, oh, you know what happened to Miss... I have to bite my lip and say, remember your mother. So I say, oh, tell me, what happened? Some of the dumbest things are interesting to people that happen that are not interesting to people they tell them to. But what will best supplement the home? Secondly, what will best coordinate with the church and the beliefs taught? Thirdly, what will best equip the child to meet the realities of life? And fourth, what will best complete my responsibility in the biblical perspective? Now, I kind of feel, see, that in the way we're set up today against the problems I sketched earlier, I kind of feel that most schools that are Christian will answer those questions better than schools that are not, the way we are set up today. There are some exceptions, and there are some unique things. So I don't try to rule all of those things out, but I kind of feel that most schools that are Christian will better answer those questions positively than schools that are not. The other factors I mentioned earlier have to be weighed. You can't dismiss them or forget them. They have to be weighed. But I'm prone to think that in most cases, they will answer those questions better than not. And that in most cases, the minus factors are less difficult to deal with than in the alternative things. I've been very happy with where my two children are going now. They've been going up to Plumsteadville, which I think is a good school. I think the Lord has given us a genius administration up there. It's not perfect on earth, but I'm happy with them going there. And they have pretty much enjoyed it. We've had good days and we've had bad days. They're not students, they're kids. They're just happy characters who don't want to be bothered by any more book work than is absolutely necessary. But I've been kind of happy with that particular thing. And although if I expect it to do my duties for me, then I'm wrong. But I think that it better enables me to fulfill what I'm trying to do. And I think that is generally true in most of our culture. Generally true. I mention, however, that the search for answers is highly individualized. You can't make a rule because the Scripture doesn't make it. It's highly individualized, and the personality of the student is a big factor. Persons who are non-spiritually motivated will be that no matter where they are. Lock them in a private room in a monastery, and they will be that. I think that by putting them in an atmosphere where their peers are of greater compatibility, I think you help them to develop more logic, but they will be that. Now, water seeks its own level, and there are several levels of water in all types of school complications. And so the personality of the student is a big factor. It's wrong to talk about your own children too much, but my oldest son, who's in the Navy, he didn't do a lot of things to please his father, but he was absolutely oblivious to peer pressure. He was absolutely oblivious to it. It did not exist for him. And consequently, if everybody was doing something, it meant nothing to him unless he wanted to do it. His personality was ideally suited. I don't know how it is today as a boy, but as a student, his personality was ideally suited for being in a multi-societal school where there were great tests. I never felt more pleased in my whole life, I think, than the night of his senior concert in high school. Dumb thing. But the choir director had included two songs from Jesus Christ Superstar in the annual concert. And there were five or six Christian kids in the choir who took exception to that, including my son. And consequently, they expressed their resentment to him on it, and he said they would not have to practice them. So when the choir would practice, these kids would be exempted. They would not have to practice the songs. And he said that those songs, would, he said they were contemporary, though, and they ought to be used. And so he said those songs would be the last on the program the night of the recital, be the last on the program, and these young people who objected could leave, he said. Well, you have to see, every parent has to weigh those things in their own decision. But when we went for the recital, the Superstar songs were not at the end of the program. They were right smack in the middle of the first half of it. Right smack in the middle of the first half of it. Well, they sang through two or three things, and they came down to the Superstar songs. And when they came down to those songs and the orchestra began to strike up the music, my son was not the leader. He's a good follower. But we had a boy from the Horsham Church, and that fellow stepped out, and about 15 kids stepped out of the choir and just marched decently off the stage. And between the choir and the director, they just in a nice, nice orderly fashion walked off the stage and were gone. And then when those songs were over, they walked back on, took their places again. That's a kind of a dumb thing. It would have been nice if they could have said, oh, we don't like this. But I tell you, I felt quite thankful that night. I was quite pleased, quite pleased. We were not so pleased when the director told the principal of the high school that they went off to work the lights for the performance. Yeah, we informed him why they really went off, and the kids, the young people themselves did. As a group, they went and made a formal protest to the principal when it was over in a nice orderly fashion about the abridgment of their spiritual rights and whatnot. Well, I was kind of pleased with that. But you see, his personality was ideally suited for that. And you may have had children like that, too. How he does today, he's out in a submarine somewhere. But that night, see, I said to myself, this fella is ideally suited for working in a societal relationship where there are various things. But some people are not that and cannot be that. And that's where your judgment is very much a factor in what they do. The availability of help with regard to school, that is a big factor. I've had friends who preferred to send their children away hundreds of miles to a school rather than have them in the local school districts where they live. I generally think that's a mistake. Generally. The Lord knows everything, and He's in charge of all those programs. But I generally think that's a mistake. However, that's one of the mistakes I haven't made yet. One I haven't made yet. And the concept of constant recrimination with yourself, that is a poor one too. Don't do that. Well, here's what I'm saying in a nutshell. In the world which we live, with the historical development we've seen, my feeling is that 9 times out of 10, the Christian school offers a better alternative education and a better possibility for growth and development. 9 times out of 10. The finances are the things that stumble us most. But when I thought that years ago, the finances were the stumbling thing. A man said to me, he said, every drunk on Skid Row can get money to get booze, he said. And he said, I think if I want the right things, I can get the money for the right things. And in the formative years of this institution, we were not notably highly paid, and we often struggled on it. And I had two children going to Christian school, which at that time was running me an aggregate of about $4,000 a year. But those bills were paid. I suffered nothing. I'm not sure how it all, but I'll just tell you they were paid. If someone says, what have you done with all that money since? Well, I haven't needed it. I'm paying it a little less now, but I've still, those bills were paid. I didn't take a second job. I just kept on doing whatever I was doing. Maybe preaching is a second job, but that hasn't always been a winner on the financial side. not always. Once in a while, a big one, but not always. And so my conclusion is that 9 times out of 10, the Christian school offers, in our present age, a better alternative in education. I think it's absurd to say that it's mandatory. I think it's crazy to say that if you don't send your children to a Christian school, you're not spiritual. I think that's absurd. It becomes an individualized matter for study, but I'm thinking that about 9 times out of 10, it offers a better alternative. The big problems we face in Christian ed are the fact that in the first place there are not enough teachers. Just being a Christian does not make you a good teacher. I run across teachers in Christian schools every year who ought to be doing something else. Emotively, they're not qualified to teach. Big yellers, big yellers. It's one thing to shout in the sermon. You do that with calculated effect. It's another thing to meet a deacon on a street and say, "You worthless, no good." It's another thing, see. And in addition to that, many who are teachers and have the emotional qualifications and whatnot just haven't had much training in teaching. Just in a nutshell. That's improving. The Association of Christian Schools has much, and their tour, that's improving, and that may change. But that's what I think. Now, what we've tried to do today is discuss questions regarding the different kinds of education. I've tried to show you in the fairest manner that I could what I think to be the positive and negative sides of each, and to sketch what I think the advantages and disadvantages are. I've told too many stories about little tailors and how they didn't grow, but they're the only kids I really know. They're the only ones I really know. And so my observation and conclusion is that the Christian school movement is a very growing movement, and about 9 times out of 10, it offers the better alternative. Whether you ever get your tax money back or not, I don't want it back, just between you and me, because with money invariably comes control. When I pay it, the government can keep it. I don't need it back. And incidentally, that's another thing. I pay it every year and never seem to miss it. Sniff, where is that tax money? I pay it every year and never seem to miss it. But I think it's a better alternative, and I think it's an alternative worth praying about and working for. But don't imagine that all the problems are solved there, and don't imagine that your own responsibilities are negated by it.
Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. We minister to people through our graduate and postgraduate degree programs, our community evening school, our cassette ministry, special seminars, and a free publication, Biblical Bulletin, containing interesting articles by biblical faculty members. For a free cassette catalog or more information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Post Office Box 9, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.